I'm your host, Annie Watson, and welcome back to another episode of R is for Rare. Sorry for the little break, getting used to my summer routine. I started a part-time job and, you know, being social for my summer before freshman year of college. It has its perks. It also has its downsides. I haven't been able to work on this, but I have an episode obviously planned for today and for next Thursday, so get excited. Make sure you're subscribed and follow me on Instagram at R is for Rare Podcast. Today's episode is with an amazing woman named Emily Parks. She works in behavioral health in Washington, D.C., and she is wanting to pursue a PhD in medical trauma. She has myopathic intestinal pseudoobstruction, which is a rare genetic disorder affecting the smooth muscle tissue of your intestines. She's a recipient of an intestine transplant, and she is the founder of POP Medical PTSD, which is a small support group type of situation. I think that's what it's technically called. I apologize to Emily if I'm butchering this description, but POP is an acronym for pissed off patients, because a lot of patients with medical PTSD, which is a very new revelation in the past like 10 or 20 years in the realm of medicine, are angry. And her goal with POP is to create a community and have people and bring awareness to what medical PTSD actually is, and for those patients to bring their anger for good, and to educate them and to come together, ask questions, and just come to terms with what this means and how to cope and deal with it along with your condition. So yeah, Emily is quite the well-rounded woman. She has a lot of interesting connections from how she started POP and her condition, and just like her condition that she's had her entire life, because it is genetic, and her intestine transplant, which I didn't even know you can get intestinal transplants until I met Emily. It's relatively new, as she says in the episode, but it's still an option. I apologize for the couple week break, but again, I said at the beginning of this recording, there will be an episode next week as well. So yeah, if you aren't subscribed to me already, be sure to subscribe, and I will leave all of Emily's information in the show notes below, her Instagram, her Twitter, her Facebook, and her website. So without further ado, let's get into the episode. Hi, Emily. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm good. So Emily, tell us a little bit about yourself, who you are, your association with the rare disease community, what you're doing with your life right now, and a fun fact about yourself.
Cool. Yeah. So my name is Emily Parks. I'm outside of the Washington, D.C. area, and I work in behavioral health. My rare disease is myopathic intestinal pseudoobstruction, which is when the smooth muscle in your digestive system is just weak and not able to absorb or digest food. So because of that, I was on IV nutrition, or PN, for about 22 years. PN is a great therapy, but unfortunately, if you're on it for a very long amount of time, and if you take it frequently, I was on it 7 days a week, you can have complications such as line infections, reduced vascular access, and liver disease. So I was showing signs of all of that. And for that reason, I got an intestinal transplant from MedStar Georgetown Hospital back in December. And now I'm just in recovery. I'm happily off of PN, but we still got some things to iron out.
Okay. Sounds amazing. Sounds great. How did that transplant process kind of work out? Like, was it something that was kind of inevitable, or was it something that you realized all of a sudden you needed? Like, how did that mentally work out?
It's actually a pretty funny story. So I moved to the DC area for work, and when I started being seen at MedStar Georgetown Hospital, it was just for PN. And how that hospital's kind of operates is the people who do the formula and are in charge of PN are in the transplant institute. So you're working with somebody who works with transplant surgeons and transplant teams. When I first moved to DC, I was immediately told that I needed a transplant. And my immediate reaction was like, nope, I'm busy. I got a job. I don't need you guys. Thanks. And it pretty much went on that, went on like that for a year. I think my doctor, like, really, she was quite stressed out about me because I kept shooting her down. But then finally, it was after, I remember it vividly. It was, I broke down crying in a clinic appointment because I had just had another hospitalization due to a Lyme infection. And I just was telling her, you know, I can't keep doing this. I can't keep pausing my life for Lyme infections. And they were also getting worse over time. Normally I would be in the general wards, but I was showing up in the ICUs more. But mostly it was, I don't want my life to be interrupted by my illness. And that was why I didn't want to go for a transplant, because of course they're going to want to see me more frequently. It's not like, here's a new organ, bye. They monitor you for a long time. And that was kind of, we had another discussion about just talking to the transplant team. So it was then that I finally, you know, just sat down and talked. And I remember it was very funny. The surgeon was like, I sat down thinking that my doctor wanted me to talk to the surgeon. And then how the surgeon was talking, it sounded like my doctor wanted the surgeon to talk to me. So we were both kind of like, what can you offer? And now that it's been over a year and I've gotten the transplant and I've come to know my surgeon more, they definitely played me. They were playing kind of hard to get, like, we don't know if we're going to do it. Which definitely it worked then, because after that meeting, I was like, I'm going to do it. I'm going to do this transplant. I'm going to take a break from work. You know, I'm going to do it. I'm going to wonder for the rest of my life, how would my life be different if I didn't do it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, kind of rewinding back to, I'm assuming the beginning was, your rare condition something that you were diagnosed with at a very young age? Is it something, or was it something you had to be diagnosed later on in life? And how was the thought of a transplant implemented early on in your diagnosis, and kind of going through the stages of life with, like, high school, college, work? How did that happen, kind of rewinding back to those times?
Yeah, so I was born with this illness. I just actually learned a couple months ago that it's due to a genetic mutation in part of the genes that's responsible for smooth muscle development, but I just found that out. I would say the first 10 years of my life, we didn't have a formal diagnosis. We just had a bunch of symptoms. And a lot of patients, you know, they talk about this diagnostic odyssey where, you know, they go through all the doctor's appointments, try the different medications, and they finally get a diagnosis and it's this big relief. I think that was kind of lost on me because once I finally had the diagnosis, there was nothing different to do. I mean, we were treating the symptoms and that was it. There is really no cure. It's just treatment and managing the symptoms. Before my transplant in December, I was evaluated two times in my life, one when I was 3 and one when I was 13. And I think the results were that it would be inevitable. It just now wasn't a good time. Also, intestinal transplants are relatively new in medicine. Georgetown has only been doing them since 2007.
Okay.
So it's inevitable, but just when? So during that, you know, as I had this diagnosis and we were treating the symptoms and I was on things like PN and I had a G-tube and an ostomy, I did go through high school and I graduated with honors. I got into a very nice university and graduated. I, you know, live independently from my parents. I work full time. So I think in my mind, I was hitting all of these kind of milestones and I was misinterpreting them as signs of health when really they were signs of resiliency. Like I definitely was in denial about how sick I was. I knew I was sick, but how sick am I?
Mm-hmm. And how, looking back to high school and college and post-graduation, mm-hmm. Kind of like young adulthood, teenage years, how, if you were to tell yourself in that time period, how sick you really were. How sick, looking back, how sick were you actually? Or was it just realizing that it was not great, but not like terrible? How sick do you think you were at that point as you look back on your life?
You know, I don't, high school, I remember in high school is when I started developing some liver disease, and it's progressed over time. I say I was pretty sick the whole time. I mean, I was getting Lyme infections 3 or 4 times a year for 15 years. So I was in and out of the hospital all the time. I would say that I was pretty sick, but, you know, I don't know if I would want to do a transplant any earlier than I did, because the medicine is still evolving.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And going into the transplant, you're saying that you were like full on set on doing it because Lyme infections were bothering you, the PN complications were just not getting any better. How did the newness of it, the like recency bias of, for lack of a better word, did that like scare you in any way with how intestinal transplants work and the treatment afterwards because of how relatively new it is? Or did that not factor into your decision at all?
I definitely did look at the statistics. The statistics did bother me. I think what's hard about intestinal transplants is that there's a lot of factors that go into like getting a transplant, and no case is alike. So when you're looking at the statistics, they don't look good, but that includes people who are really, really, really sick, and like maybe a transplant will let them live 5 more years. And then that's different from like a newborn baby with no, like I'm somebody who's fortunate enough that I didn't have any kind of skeletons in the closet. I didn't have like a dormant virus in me that could pop back up once my immune system suppressed. I had pretty reversible or not progressed liver disease. I'm young, I'm healthy, I'm active. So looking at the statistics, it was scary, but I think at some point I just had nothing else to do but just trust my doctors. There were times when I was like, well, I can't believe I'm doing this, but I know I'm going to do it. But I would talk to them. And I remember my doctor, I think she was concerned a couple of times that I was going to bail on her. But, you know, it came down to the rapport, like, you know, she must really think that this will increase my chances of a long life.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned just now that you maintain an active lifestyle. What does that look like for you now with your transplant? I know it would have been different if I'd asked you when you were still on PN, but how do you maintain an active lifestyle with your condition?
So I do ballroom dancing.
That's awesome.
Thank you. I've been doing it about 3 years now. That's my primary form of exercise. I go to my dance studio maybe 3 times in a week.
That's awesome. I love that.
So I did that before the transplant. And, you know, before the transplant, there weren't a lot of exercise options. I mean, like running hurt. I'm not very balanced. I'm a little clumsy. And then the big thing was that because my colon wasn't attached to the rest of my digestive system, I couldn't hydrate myself.
Mm-hmm.
I really avoided sports because, like, I don't know, my teammates could drink water and then they'd be hydrated. But for me, it was like, it wasn't going to happen for me. So now that I've gotten my transplant, I'm still working out some kinks in what I want my exercise routine to be. But I want to start yoga. I did a little bit earlier and then I had a surgery and now I'm about to have another surgery. But getting into yoga here is very good. I go hiking with friends. I love swimming. But dancing is the big one.
That's awesome. I have never heard of somebody with a rare condition that does ballroom dancing as an exercise. Fine. So what made you, what got you into that?
So my parents ballroom danced for like 15 years, and I remember growing up and watching them. I've always wanted to try it, and when I moved to the DC area, I realized, like, I came here and I didn't have any friends. I didn't know anybody, so I was like, well, I have to do something besides working all the time, because I'm going to burn myself out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And has there, I mean, obviously, besides the Georgetown Hospital that you've mentioned, but is there anything about living in DC with a rare disease that you love? And like, how does DC, like living there, like how does that play into like your attitudes towards not just life, but also like life with a rare disease?
There's a lot of non-for-profits out here that do work with rare disease. So it seems like in rare disease, there's a lot of legislative advocacy. So I think it makes sense being in the capital. So there's Every Life Foundation, there's NORD, there's a couple of smaller ones. A lot of people with rare diseases find themselves out here. So I think that's nice, being closer to the action, so to say. The big thing is that, like, I didn't move to DC thinking I was going to get a transplant, and I just happened to be in a place where I was at one of the top transplant centers in the US that does intestinals. So I think I just got really lucky in that, because there are people who, they may live in Arkansas and they have to cross borders.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's definitely a reality for a lot of people. Was that something, I mean, when you were thinking, when you had that transplant option, in since you've been living in DC and you went about it, were there like thoughts where it was like, wow, I could have been anywhere else? Was it like, did it ever feel like it was, you were just like drawn to DC and it just like, it was like everything worked out? Did you ever get that feeling with the transplant? Or
I didn't with DC. The reason I ended up in DC was I graduated from Boston University, and I lived in Boston for about 2 years after graduation, and I was just sick of Boston. It was a little bit too intense. I mean, it was really hard to break into the health industry over there. So my parents lived in DC, so I just used them as a way to get somewhere else.
Yeah. And that's not a bad thing. I think that, I mean, especially since you live independently, like that's awesome. And no shame to people who still live with their parents. Like that's not a bad thing. But yeah, that's awesome. I know, like, sadly, with the way the healthcare system works out in the US, and it's like this abroad, I bet, but like the way it works out, it's kind of, you kind of have to work out some health logistics because of like location.
Yeah.
And I know people who have had to like cross multiple state lines and to get to search for the right people. And I know, like, I just so happened to move to the Chicago area right before my symptoms set in, and Chicago is great for sleep medicine. Yeah. Like, I know location somewhat matters. But yeah, that's interesting. I know that, and Boston has a great health.
Yeah, Boston has great hospitals.
Yeah. And how was it like living there with your condition? I know you said it got too intense as a city, which I don't blame you. It can get intense probably after you've lived there for 6 years, but, how did you feel with your condition, living in Boston?
I would say that was pretty easy going through school. I think I struggled like any other person who's just graduated from college. It's a little bit of, what do I want to do with my life, or what do I want my career to be? For me, when I graduated, I had no idea what I wanted to do. I knew I was going to go to graduate school eventually, but I didn't want to quite go there. So I worked in the restaurant industry, which was very stressful. And I remember my back hurt all the time. So that was hard. Maybe if you have a rare disease, maybe don't work in the food industry. It may be a bit much, but if you want to be a chef or something, go for it. I was just a waitress.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't think it was harder because of my rare disease. I think it's just that time of your life is just kind of difficult.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And on top of it, dealing with a rare disease doesn't.
Yeah. Yeah. I know, like, post-grad can never be, I mean, I can't speak from experience, but seeing how stressful post-grad can be, and just feeling like you have to have your life together when you really don't. Like, yeah. It's all very arbitrary. As I'm going through college apps right now, and I mean, it's fine. Like, it can be overwhelming, but it's kind of cool. Like, the college process, it's really fun and it's kind of interesting. But also, it's like, when you take a step back, it's like, this is all very arbitrary.
Yeah.
And very weirdly arbitrary. Like, we have to tell 17 and 18 year olds that they want to know somewhat exactly, they should know where they want to go, and they should have an idea of what they want to study. And they only have so much time when they're in college to decide what they want to study. And maybe they'll change their mind. But if they change their mind, then they'll have to spend more money in grad school. And it's in having to figure out what to do after graduating undergrad. Like, it's all so weirdly arbitrary.
And the big kicker is, whatever you major in, it doesn't mean you have to, like, go into that field. I know somebody in computer forensics, and he got a bachelor's in English.
Huh.
That's so interesting. I know somebody else who does compensation analysis for, like, HR companies. She studied early childhood education.
Huh.
So it's not this box that you're stuck in college where you're like, okay, I can only do something related to biology. It's just get a degree.
Yeah.
Just get any degree and then be proactive in your life, because that's what's going to get you a good career, is you doing, like, things like a podcast, your own research, you know, doing something that you love on a consistent basis, whether that's ballroom dancing or, you know, climbing mountains. Your major doesn't really matter so much. It does matter in the first years afterwards. It does impact how much you'll be able to make. But in the long run, just go with whatever feels right at the moment.
Exactly. Exactly. On that note, we're going to take a little break, and then we'll get back to the rest of the episode with Emily. And we are back. So, Emily, you mentioned that you work in behavioral health in DC. What made you choose behavioral health, and what do you do for your job?
So I grew up in a family where my dad's a psychiatrist, my stepmom's a former therapist, and we talked a lot about psychology and relationships, and kind of how thinking styles can be different growing up. So psychology was something that I was interested in way before college. So that's what I studied in school. Right now I work for a mental health agency, doing authorizations. So submitting authorizations for services so that we can get paid.
Okay. So is that authorization for, like, help, like crisis helplines and, like, therapy, or is it, like, medications?
So the department I work out of is the vocational department. So we help people with severe mental illness find and keep employment.
Okay.
So it's submitting authorizations for those job searching services, or helping people keep their jobs services.
Okay. Okay. That's very interesting. And how do you like it so far?
I really like it. I started off being a job coach myself, and then I was a supervisor. I moved into this role because I'm curious on how, kind of like behind the curtain, how does healthcare work?
Mm-hmm.
You know, how do we get paid for things? What's kind of the politics of it? And so I thought, you know, this would be a great next step into ultimately learning more about healthcare as a nation. Let me just take this one small piece here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And your Instagram, Pop Medical PTSD, what got you started with Pop, and how has that gone so far?
Oh, well, Pop actually started with ballroom dance, of all things.
Oh, wow.
So back to ballroom dance. I started it, and my poor teacher, I would not look at anybody. I wouldn't look at anybody when I danced. I was all stiff and I was all rigid. I really wouldn't talk to anybody. I was probably a nightmare for like the first 6 months, and it was really stressful for me. Like my back always hurt and my shoulders were always tense. And I remember I started ballroom dance lessons shortly after I started work. And maybe about 3 months into my job, I went to Florida, and I knew I was stressed out, but I was like, it's my job. I mean, my job's demanding. Like, it's probably my job. That's why I'm stressed out. And I remember coming back and being at work, and it was actually a great day. And I was like, wow, I'm just really refreshed. A vacation is what I needed. And then I showed up to dance, and instantly my day was ruined. The tension came back. I was just so shy. I would make eye contact. I was just like hard to dance with. But for some reason, I kept going. I kept showing up. Probably because dance lessons are really expensive. So I was like, you're going to show, if you're paying for this, you're going to show up.
Yeah.
So I was figuring out how to dance, and I was being all stiff and rigid. And in this time, I was learning more about post-traumatic stress disorder from work. Mm-hmm. And I was talking to more clients. And a few of them were sharing with me their traumas, or I was talking to therapists to do coordination, and they would explain, you know, when the client does this, this is what they're trying to get. So it really got me thinking about like behavior and responses to environment. And it was just one day that I was like, you're like past being nervous at this point. It's been like 6 months. Like, what is going on? Why am I so stressed out? What is triggering me every single time that I came here? And I realized it was my time as a child in the hospitals. I'm pretty nervous around men. All of my doctors were men. I'm pretty nervous when people get very close to me. I think that's because a majority of the physical interactions I got when I was a kid was being poked or prodded or stuck or cut. And so when people get close to me, I kind of like, you know, tense up, cause I'm kind of prepared for them to either do something or, you know, judge my body. Now, of course, in the hospital I was never told like I'm the problem, but after years and years and years of being like, well, you know, the liver's doing this and the kidneys are doing this and here's this problem, I think you begin to absorb what other people are saying, and you do kind of put it on you because you're hearing these messages over and over and over again, and you try your best to, you know, take the medicine, go to your appointments, and sometimes you get sicker anyway. So it was once I realized that my discomfort with ballroom dance was connected to my early childhood experiences being in the hospital and interacting with people, that started kind of opening the gates into me becoming a more relaxed dancer and person. I took a lot of calculated steps, such as trying eye contact, or, you know, saying hello, or, you know, not fleeing the studio as soon as I can, socialize a little bit. And so I was doing that for a while, and it dawned on me that, like, I bet I'm not the only one who has experienced trauma. I mean, I was showing signs of trauma, and I'm sure I'm not the only one who has had trauma as a child due to chronic illness. And so I was reading more on if there's something called like medical PTSD. Is there something or any kind of literature or articles out there about people who are developing symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder from their interactions with the healthcare system, whether that be hospitalization, surgeries, inpatient, outpatient appointments, or even breaches in communication between providers and patients? Are there things like medical gaslighting, where people don't feel like they're being heard or understood, or, you know, full-blown being like, oh no, that's not what's happening? Is there medical anxiety where people, you know, delay seeking healthcare because it's just triggering? And I know that was something I was guilty of too. Like whenever I would go to my doctor's appointments, Georgetown has kind of like these door greeters who can kind of help you get around the hospital. And so they all would, you know, say hi to everybody when you came in, and I always wore my headphones and put my head down because I was already so tense that I couldn't interact with anybody. Like, I'm just on fight or flight response. I'm, you know, hypervigilance. And that's kind of how POP started. So POP, it got me thinking about medical PTSD, got me reading some books, some articles, and then I was hearing more about it in conferences too, with patients, patient-led conferences specifically. And I realized that there was no kind of resource out there. There wasn't anything for patients, but it was definitely a topic. And it's also not, you know, it's not like in the DSM or anything. This is very much like a term that's just been coined by patients themselves. So I decided that, you know, this is really something that needs to be worked on. And so I started POP. It stands for pissed off patients, which is a reflection of how trauma, a lot of people who have trauma, they're quite angry. And it's okay to be angry about the trauma you experience, but instead of using anger to destroy, it's anger to construct better things. So it's not, it's a resource that can be used by both patients and providers if they, you know, wanted to know about how to provide more trauma-informed care for better patient outcomes. Because at the end of the day, if patients feel, you know, stressed and not heard, their healthcare is going to suffer. Their outcomes are going to suffer.
Mm-hmm. That's amazing. That's so interesting that it all comes back to ballroom dancing.
Yeah.
Have you encountered anybody that like has used it and they get back to you and they talk about how it's changed them? Like, have you gotten any responses?
Yeah, definitely.
And how do you react when people message you saying like, this worked amazing? Like, how do you react to that?
You know, I think I'm always so grateful that people tell me because, you know, I'm just kind of trying my best out here in this world.
Mm-hmm.
And so getting that feedback is really kind of reassuring, for anybody, like, but for everything that we start new, we're always kind of unsure at first.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, I think I just blush a little bit. I don't know if it makes me nervous or something, but it's just, I really like it. I really like when people reach out to me and it motivates me to do more. So POP really started with doing biweekly discussion groups on different topics for medical PTSD. Topics could be like validation, relationships and dating, trust, imposter syndromes. And now I'm going to move into phase two, where I'm going to do one-on-one interviews and start collecting data because I eventually want to get a PhD in medical trauma, but I want to get a jump on it now. And I want to get the patient perspective now, because I'm sure once I'm in school, it's going to become very like academic and journal-y. And I just kind of also don't want to wait. I want to do it now, but I'm not quite ready to start a PhD program. First, mm-hmm. I want to get a master's.
Yeah. And what would you get your master's in? Would you also get it in trauma, or would it be less broad?
I would want to do an MBA.
Okay.
You know, hospitals and medicines, it's a business.
Mm-hmm.
And I think understanding that foundation is going to be helpful for getting an in at maybe working at a hospital or working for, you know, the government. You got to understand where the money comes from, because money does factor into a lot of things.
Mm-hmm. And how has starting POP transformed your views about your own experience? And were you, I hope you can answer this if you want to, you don't have to, but were you ever like officially diagnosed with medical PTSD, or is that something that is more so a self-diagnosed aspect because it's so newly coined as a term?
Yeah, I'm not formally diagnosed with any form of PTSD, but in my opinion, as a behavioral health provider, and I'm not licensed or anything, but if you identify with the symptoms, then it's valid enough to say this is something that I struggle with.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't need a diagnosis from somebody else to know that you're struggling with something and you want to get help. POP is a resource for anybody who's wondering if they have medical PTSD. those who know that they do and don't have a formal diagnosis. Some people do have a formal diagnosis. It's a support system.
Mm-hmm. And do you, with the pandemic, has it been more virtual discussion groups? Discussion groups play out?
It started in, I believe, May of 2020.
Okay.
May of 2021. So it's all been virtual so far. I think it's going to stay virtual. Everybody's just in a lot of different places. And I am wondering if discussion groups, it's hard to talk about trauma in a group. And so that's why I'm also moving to these one-on-ones for both more data and, people may be more willing to kind of open up if it's just me.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, I'm not really sure how to put in the data, but that'll be something that how to like form the questions and where the data will go. But that's something that I'm working on with a family friend.
And how is this something you wish you had when you were realizing that you had some form of medical, like the signs of PTSD? Is that something that you wish you had all those like years ago?
Yeah, definitely. Once I realized that I struggle with medical PTSD, this impacts my life outside of my life as a patient, things started getting easier. I was able to make eye contact with the people that I was dancing with because, I was kind of in this survival instinct beforehand. And now I was like able to kind of reality check myself and say, okay, you're at the dance studio. Nobody's going to take your blood. Nobody's going to try and feel your spleen or whatever, and then say there's something wrong with you. Literally, people are just here to dance. And I feel less stressed. I feel happier. There are social situations that I'm sure for everybody, sometimes you get anxious socially, mm-hmm. but it's easier for me to kind of talk myself through it.
Mm-hmm.
So I wish I had a resource like this growing up, because I think the scary thing about medical PTSD is it's scary to look at kind of the ugliness that one has been through, that is trauma. But then once you look through it and understand it and process it and continue to do so, life gets easier.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to look at, but there's a good outcome to coping and dealing, and that's just a better quality of life.
Mm-hmm. And what does coping look like in your life? I know it's different for every single person, mm-hmm. and we all cope with different, sometimes similar things, but they're not all exactly the same. So how does that work out, both with your rare condition, with your work, with even like the stresses of ballroom dancing? Like what does coping look like for you?
So I am a big fan of self-talk. So I kind of talk to myself, or if I'm angry about something, I talk the anger out, and it can either be with a friend or it's just by myself. I mean, I have a studio, so I don't have any roommates. So I would be like, who are you yelling at? I think that really helps kind of process things. And then it kind of gets that kind of intense charged emotion out. So I can kind of step back and now be like, okay, maybe I'll deal with it like that. Or, maybe this is what I'm feeling. Talking to friends. I have great friends. And so one of my friends, Mike, whenever I call him up, he and I'm angry about something, I'm just like, okay, Mike, I'm just angry and I'm just gonna talk, and you just tell me I'm right, and then we can talk about it for real. And so he's like, okay. And I just talk and I just get angry, and then I'm like, okay, now we can talk about it in a constructive way. And then we'll break it down. He does the same thing with me. He'll be like, okay, I just need to get something out.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome, though. That's definitely a more productive way to vent to people than just.
Yeah.
I think it's great
to have friends who challenge you too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm definitely one where I don't mind the compliments, but I thrive more on constructive criticism.
Yeah.
I'm not that easily offended. So even if I'm getting angry, like if you get angry about the dumbest things, like tell me that it's dumb, because I won't realize that it's dumb because I'm overwhelmed with emotion. So you might as well tell me.
Yeah, yeah.
If there's like other things worth stressing about. Yeah, exactly.
That's one of my things that I ask. I'm like, is this a reasonable thing to be thinking and feeling?
Exactly. Because sometimes it's hard to let go. And even when people tell you that it's dumb or it's irrational to be wrong about that, or whatever constructive critique you want to insert into that blank right there. But it's sometimes it's even harder to like let go. But once they like talk it through with you and they're like, these are the reasons X, Y, and Z as to why this is dumb and not worth your time and your mental stress, it helps.
Yeah.
Because I'm not going to get to that point on my own. I just don't work that way. I'm going to get all overwhelmed about it even more unless I talk to someone, even if it's myself.
Yeah. And I think it sounds, when we talk out loud, it sounds different than how it is in our heads.
Exactly. That's why I like that as well. I do that, especially when I drive.
Yeah.
Especially in the car rides. And if there is traffic, it just kind of adds to it. So I get more out of it. I get more out of the venting with myself, but it's healthy. I can't get into journaling because I cannot write down bad things. Like I get all emotional and like, I don't want to like trigger too many negative emotions all at once every single day. So I like looking at things in an optimist. I'm an optimist. I look at things, I look at things half glass, half full type of situation. So venting is better for me than writing because I'm going to forget what I'm going to say instead of just saying it out loud.
Yeah. Well, and then once it's out there, the words kind of disappear into the air. There isn't any, like you like with journaling, you could always go back and read what you wrote when you were angry and it can restart the anger. But I find with me doing self-talk, those words aren't ever going to float back to me. Like they're not in print in the sky or something.
Yeah. It's not going to like a boomerang and like come and back and bite me in the butt.
Yeah,
exactly. It's a win-win situation. One question I have for you is that how has your family been with like supporting you since your diagnosis? Like how has the family dynamic been with living with a rare condition and also doing behavioral health and POP?
So my family has been very, very supportive. My dad's a doctor, so he spent a lot of time in the hospitals with me, going on second, third, fourth opinions when I was an infant. I think as I've gotten older, I do feel kind of a disconnect with my illness and my parents, mostly because I handle everything on my own now. And also I think that's just a part of getting older. You kind of aren't, your relationship with your parents change over time. They're really supportive of POP. My dad's like, he keeps saying, you're onto something, you could write a book, which is really, really like encouraging. And other people have taught me that too. Had told me that too. So it motivates me to keep going and, just to take my time. I'm kind of somebody who I'm like, once the task is done, it's done. But this is going to be something where I'm never going to be done.
And do you like that about it?
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's always, I think one of the kind of uncertainties of being a young adult is, who am I going to be? What am I going to be kind of known for? What kind of imprint am I going to leave behind? And if you don't know what you want to do, then it can kind of feel isolating when, especially if you, a lot of your friends know what they're doing. And so it is reassuring to me that it's like, okay, this is what I'm going to do. It's all going to lead back to this. I have a meaning. I have, purpose to, I'm not just working, getting a paycheck and, dancing. I'm doing something I love, being paid for something I love, and getting to use the money to dance. I'm not somebody that can just work a job. The job has to have meaning to me, and my current job does, and Pop does too.
Do you see Pop expanding in the future into more social media outlets, TED Talks, books? Where do you see audiobooks, podcasts? Where do you see Pop in a year, five years? Where do you see it going?
Definitely I'm going to start a Twitter soon. Social media is not my strength.
That's okay.
It was always a struggle, even in like high school when Facebook was hot. So I have an Instagram. I do have a Facebook, but I find that Facebook is actually kind of a hard medium to use, for advocacy websites. I'm going to make the Twitter. I do want to do a TED Talk. That is definitely on my bucket list. That's been on my bucket list for like years now, and so I'm super psyched that I actually have something to talk about. I always was like, I'm just gonna do a TED Talk, I don't know what it's gonna be on. So hey, TED Talk people, if you're listening,
hit up Emily Parks in any way you can.
Email me, call me, beat me if you want to reach me.
Exactly. If TED Talk people were listening, I think I would fall on the floor in shock. I think I would need to be in my room for a few days just to wrap my head around that. But
yeah,
hey,
no, I would, my heart would instantly start racing.
I would be like, oh my goodness, it has reached the TED Talk people. Who knows?
Yeah, they might be listening. What I love about the rare disease community is that it's very much in its infancy and it's growing. And it's so supportive of other people's projects. You know, there isn't this kind of competition. In some areas, I find that there is a little bit of competition, but that can be just kind of the group dynamic. But I find that there's podcasts, there's people doing legislative advocacy, people who are talking about artificial intelligence and genetic testing. I'm kind of doing this behavioral health approach. I know somebody who's written a book. I know someone who's doing a documentary, and it's growing. And so while it evolves, it's just great to kind of be like I kind of imagine myself in when I'm 60 and being like, yeah, I was part of, the building of the rare disease community. TED Talk would be great. I think a book, definitely a book after a PhD. I don't know about audiobooks. If somebody later wants to talk to me about an audiobook, I'd be down for it. But that hadn't come to my mind, so thank you for that suggestion.
Of course. I mean, anytime. If you need me to narrate your book that you'll write in a few years, I am happy to do so.
Perfect. Excellent.
Just hit me up in 3 or 4 years, and I will narrate your audiobook. Everybody has heard plenty of me. They're probably like, oh no, she's gonna narrate more.
No, I'm sure they're not thinking that at all.
Yeah, I know. It's so interesting, the world of audio and video and even writing. People are always like, newspapers are gonna go out of business. The New York Times is still doing pretty well.
Yeah,
newspapers and books. I love a good trip to Barnes and Noble, and I'm currently on Book Talk right now, so I'm getting all the good book recommendations.
Nice.
So I think with technology again, TikTok and Instagram, people are reading more, people are going to print more, and the written word isn't going away. Even though audio and video and photos are kind of overwhelming it all, Twitter, look at Twitter.
Yeah.
Exhibit A, Twitter. Twitter.
Write a haiku on Twitter.
Exactly. You can, people write the most random things on Twitter, and some get most people get paid for it somehow. They get paid for doing social media, and
wow,
it's so weird. It's so weird, especially because there are people my age who have millions of followers on Instagram and YouTube.
I don't know how they do it.
And I'm like, how on earth do you live your life? I want a true, transparent look into a day in your life.
Yeah, how do you mentally get millions?
Exactly. And mentally, that's got to take a toll.
Yeah.
But Anyways, back to my point. There's so many avenues that people can grow in now, and especially the rare disease community, it's growing like insanely. It's going in the right direction, which is good because change is necessary. And there are some things that should have already been changed that haven't been, but there's so many of us that change is going to happen, both good and bad, but mainly good because we have ideas in our heads that we want people to know about and the world knows about them.
Well, it's I'm seeing a lot in the healthcare conferences or pharmaceuticals that they're companies that they're more interested in the rare disease voice or the patient voice, to the point that, you know, there is more pushback from the rare disease community to get paid for our services. Definitely it's not well paid. It's very much a passion project that you do on the side. But the fact that these large healthcare related companies are interested in the patient voice means that, you know, there's value in it. They're going to put some of their budget behind it.
Mm-hmm. And hopefully that grows more. I mean, nobody's doing it for the money. Nobody's doing it for the money. Like I definitely wouldn't be, but like, there's not that much money, but hopefully that changes and big pharma switches their, I mean, they're always going to need to make money. They're going to need, like, they're making money on people not being healthy, which is really weird when you think. As soon as I said that, I realized how weird that is. Like,
well, that's why I want to get an MBA.
But hey, like, hopefully at some point they slowly, the disparity between profits over people isn't as large as it is right now. I think even within the pandemic, it's definitely shifted towards more people, again, especially in the rare disease community. But hopefully that comes to a point where health or wealth wise, not health and wealth wise, it's not so drastic as it is right now.
Mm-hmm.
Because I mean, we're giving our services through clinical trials by existing.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
Well, and really we're the patients. We're the whole reason that you're here.
Exactly. We're the reason that they're making money.
Yeah.
So we might as well get some of it, but again, not in it for the money, but hopefully at some point there is more of a somewhat equal playing fields with the rare disease and chronic illness disability space, but maybe one day.
I'm sure we'll get there.
Yeah, I'm sure we will too. My last question for you, Emily, and I ask this to all of my guests, is why do you want to share your story?
I want to share my story because I think medical PTSD is very real. I think it's very, I think it's just experienced by a lot of patients, both rare disease, chronically ill, and as well as people with acute illnesses. I know people who have shared with me their trauma and they are healthy as a horse, but maybe they broke their arm when they were 3 and had a horrible experience. And these early experiences, these traumas, can kind of lay dormant in our minds for a long time and then come out of nowhere. I think, you know, the healthcare system is so chaotic, and especially as a patient, this is my body we're talking about. This is the only body I get.
Mm-hmm.
So I should feel heard and I should feel, you know, valued and not kind of pushed aside. And that's what a lot of patients feel. So I think I really wanted to share my story because I don't believe that I'm the only one out there struggling with medical PTSD. And now I know that I'm not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's a great way to end. But also because like people, to my listeners, you are not alone, whether you have a condition or you don't, whether your struggles are health related or not, you're not alone. And especially because medical PTSD is still somewhat like new in the world timeline of healthcare. It's new. It's a little baby. It's a little infant baby. It's gotta be taken care of. And some people are all struggling with the little infant baby of medical PTSD. So we gotta treat it somehow. We gotta nurture it and we gotta take care of it in any way we can. And POP is definitely a great resource for that to anybody who's interested.
Yeah, check us out. PopMedicalPTSD.org.
Yes. Yes. Check out Emily. popmedicalptsd.org and pop_medicalptsd on Instagram. Thank you so much, Emily, for coming on the podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Of course. Of course. Anytime. Again, maybe one day I'll narrate your audiobook. But yes, everyone go check out Emily and her amazing work. And be sure to subscribe to R Is So Rare on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And follow me on Instagram at R Is So Rare Podcast. And stay tuned for another episode next Thursday. See you guys then. Bye, everyone.